Timeless and the Julie Hartman YouTube channel, where in addition to Timeless, you can catch my show with Dennis Prager, aptly named Dennis and Julie. That's every Monday at 1 o'clock Pacific, 4 o'clock Eastern. And then Timeless is Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. Thank you so much for being here. If there's one timeless truth about the human existence, it is that many of us suffer from negative thoughts. Maybe psychopaths don't suffer from negative thoughts, but the vast majority of us do. And honestly, I feel like I'm kind of the poster child for this phenomenon. For my whole life, I have motivated myself by repeatedly telling myself all of the things that I do wrong. Even when I would do something objectively well, whether it was finishing in a top place in a swim meet or getting a good score on a test or filming an episode of Timeless, even if I do something that was objectively good, afterwards I will sit and I will relentlessly nitpick all of the ways that I could have been better. And if there isn't a way that I could have been better, don't worry, I'll make something up and then ruminate about that. I used to think that this is what made me great, and that this is what gave me a competitive edge over other people. That when some people would be satisfied with their performance, I would go home and find every single way that I could make it better. But as I get older, I'm realizing that yes, in some ways, this rumination has helped me, but increasingly, I think it is hurting me. And I think this is true of a lot of people. When you are constantly criticizing yourself and allowing negative thoughts to infiltrate into your mind, what you're really doing is holding yourself back from achieving your full potential. So I've really tried to seek out ways that I can have a healthier relationship with my thoughts. And I've been really lucky to encounter the work of Nancy Collier, who is my guest today. I actually discovered her in the Epic Times. And basically, the show is just like a living advertisement for the Epic Times newspaper. Such a great newspaper. And in that article that they did about Nancy, they talked about her book, which is called Can't Stop Thinking, How to Let Go of Anxiety and Free Yourself from Obsessive Rumination. And I read that book and I realized that having bad thoughts, ruminating, is actually an addiction. People just think it's a feature of your mind. No, in many cases, you can become addicted to negative thoughts. But unlike drugs or alcohol, which are addictions that you can hypothetically remove from your life, you can go throughout your whole life and never pick up a drink or never take a drug, you can't stop thinking. It's always something that you have to do. So in our lives, we really ought to make sure that we have a healthy relationship with our thoughts. So I'm very pleased to welcome Nancy to the show today. In addition to her book, Can't Stop Thinking, she's written several others, including The Emotionally Exhausted Woman, Why You're Feeling Depleted and How to Get What You Need. And also, this is next on my list, The Power of Off, The Mindful Way to Stay Sane in a Virtual World. How apropos, as I just did a show on social media. Nancy, welcome to Timeless. Thanks for being here.
Delighted to be here. And all those three books are related.
Are they?
Because in some way, tech jacks up the thinking mind. Right. And so whatever your particular addiction is, yours is self-criticism, that gets amplified. It feeds the mind, and the emotional exhaustion in many women and men as well stems from this relentlessness of the mind that we also believe we have to chase around. That we have to engage with every thought that comes down the pipe, that every thought is important or relevant, and most importantly, true. And so we get actually mentally exhausted. That's what exhausts us. So many of my clients come to me and they talk about the circumstances of their lives, but what's really creating their suffering is the climate in their mind. And it's this, it's not, as you said very insightfully, you can't stop the thoughts from coming down the pike. You know, the heart pumps blood, the kidneys filter toxins, the mind generates this gunk called thoughts. Some of them in there are interesting and forward moving, but 80% are negative and 95% are repetitive. So the majority of it is really not useful for us, but we are so identified with our thoughts. We don't see them as something separate from us coming down the pike. Never going to stop. What changes is that we get some distance from them. So we see, oh, look at this floating by, and we don't jump on its train. Or we become the one listening or not listening to the thoughts rather than imagining that we're the speaker, we're the voice that's shouting those thoughts at us. We start to develop a sense of compassion for, wow, what is it like to be told we're not good enough over and over and over again? Our identification shifts from the thoughts to the one listening to them. And then they start to lighten and we stop taking them quite so seriously.
Mm. That is one of the biggest takeaways that I had from your book. And honestly, I feel stupid that I didn't realize it before, but it is such a true thing that not every thought that comes into your mind about yourself is true. And when I would have all of these, you know, moments of self-flagellation and, you know, I, for instance, you know, after I do an episode, I would think, oh gosh, I stumbled over that word or I didn't say that as eloquently as I could have. Maybe no one noticed that I stumbled over the word. Maybe it wasn't as big of a deal. Maybe I actually did say what I meant to say as eloquently as I could. And so that takeaway of yours is just everything. That yes, sometimes the criticisms of yourself are valid, but sometimes they're made up.
Often, really, Julie, they're just things we've heard before. They're really just regurgitations of something our parents said to us. Or what's interesting to me, and it feels very paradoxical to some degree, is under every negative thought is a kind of faulty attempt to help ourselves. So, you know, this broken monkey, you know, in Buddhism, they think of the mind as a kind of drunk monkey in our mind, and he's been stung by bees on top of it, right? So he's by nature agitated, and the thinking in this crazy drunk monkey is that, or out of order computer, you could think of it as, is that if I continually remind you of everything you did wrong, I'll make you better. I won't let you be a sloth. Because your basic nature is, if I don't constantly shout at you, you'll lay on the couch and eat bonbons. So there is this faulty idea, which we are conditioned to believe, that that is some way of working on your behalf. And what we end up doing with that, tragically really, is enjoying what's also good in what we did. So we kidnap the present moment from ourselves and we turn it to wreckage in this idea that we're servicing ourselves. Part of the misunderstanding is that if we don't nitpick and nitpick and nitpick, right, that we'll never get better. We'll never take the lessons from maybe what we could do better forward. And yet, life is about both and. So, wow, I did that really well. This is amazing. And, not but, that's the big change. But maybe there is, wow, when that happened, I could have gone in that direction. It's this and that sits in between. But the faulty monkey mind imagines if it lets in anything about the joy or the credit or the acknowledgement of our goodness, that it is giving you a free pass to never get better. That's saying you're perfect. That's saying you're done. And so much of finding freedom in thought, not from thought, Again, we think of it as, oh, I've got to make my thoughts positive, or I've got to make my thoughts stop. Not going to happen. We can try on positive thinking. It's like a hat on dirty hair. It works for a little bit, but when the going gets tough, we return to there's something wrong with you. You're broken. So we have to find a way to see our thoughts out in front of us, maybe even see what are they intending. They imagine that helps us and keeps us competitive. Okay, so maybe that was a very young belief, right? So we see all that, but there's an us and a set of thoughts, and we know that they're not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. That starts to be this place of freedom. So then we can choose which thoughts we engage with. And we can actually turn away from them with a simple, that's actually not helpful. It's not helpful.
One of the tips that you give in your book, Can't Stop Thinking, is to treat your negative thoughts as a person outside of you who is criticizing you. And that allows you to have more awareness of them. When you imagine them being spoken to you from someone else. And I really love that idea, because then you can, it's sort of like you're interacting with another person. It's very hard to be objective with your mind. It's certainly hard to be objective with, you know, in everyday life in general, but it's easier when you're talking with another person. And so that's really helped me to literally imagine someone telling me what I'm telling myself. And that way I have a bit more discernment of going, okay, well, that person's exaggerating on this. Maybe there's a kernel of truth in what they say in that. And I'm going to take, you know, 10% of it and internalize it instead of 100% of it.
But that's so, it's so interesting to me, because if anyone talked to us the way our mind talked to us, we would run.
Yes.
We would run the other way. And so I always encourage people to name their negative voices. So if you have one that tells you everything you did wrong, maybe that's Linda. If you have one that tells you the sky is falling, it's going to be a disaster, maybe that's Jane. But we give them to, oh, look who's here, Linda, to tell me everything wrong with me. Wonderful. And then we start to get in a kind of, we can even bring in humor. You know, you don't get to criticize, you don't get to attack me. Mm. You don't get to destroy me, right?
I love that.
Does this actually resonate with who I know myself to be, this version of me? And sometimes it's interesting with negative thought, particularly self-criticism, which is, so we get them out in front of us, we name them, that further objectifies them, right? And then we can bring in someone who loves us, who would say, but what would so-and-so say about us, right? We get the conversation going in front of us, right? She believes this about me. So it becomes a kind of, it becomes more obvious the destructiveness of this voice trying to actually harm us. So we getting them out in front of us and doing that is a wonderful exercise when it comes to self-criticism. The other thing we sometimes have to look at is we might have had parents who were very critical or at high standards. Maybe not. Some kids come out of the womb with this very perfectionistic, very hard on themselves quality, which didn't come from parents. But very often we'll have a parent who is quite critical or a caretaker of some sort. And what's interesting is we internalize that voice so as to make that parent forever right about us. Because the cognitive dissonance between, wait, they told us all these things that we were not enough about, and yet that's not true. And so to experience that gap feels too painful. So we join them and we become the one telling us how bad we are. So we want to look at, where was this born? Where did this hating me and telling me what's wrong with me? What is my fundamental not enoughness? Why is it so hard for me to acknowledge I'm all so good? Am I a work in progress like every human? Yes. But it's not this very primitive monkey mind wants it to be either or. Either I'm crap or I'm spectacular. And it doesn't work that way.
You perfectly segued into my question, which is, where does this come from? And you've been talking a lot about mm-hmm. the role of parents, and I can imagine that that's true. You also said something a few minutes ago, which particularly resonated, that we're trying subconsciously to help ourselves when we're criticizing ourselves. And I also think part of that is that we're almost trying to protect ourselves for when other people criticize us. And, you know, we've in this, so far in this discussion, been focusing a lot on self-doubt, which is, you know, something I identified as something I struggle with. And from what I know from your book, something that everybody struggles with. But another part of this is that in addition to self-doubt, a lot of people have anxiety about the future, which is another form of obsessive rumination. And I would imagine that part of that also comes from this idea that you want to protect yourself against something bad happening by already imagining it, going through the motions of somebody criticizing you, going through the anxiety of your parent dying, so that when it happens, maybe the blow is softened. Is that right?
Right. Completely spot on. Catastrophizers, right? The what ifers.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's so tragic to me because we don't know. We can't bear not knowing. The human condition is we want to know. We want to be prepared. We want to deny life on life's terms, which is that it is not entirely in our control. And so this primitive mind, again, which never stops thinking, 25-8, 25-8, around the clock, cradle to the grave, it imagines that by, you know, creating this disastrous scenario and living it as if it's already here, we will avoid being blindsided when it happens. And the only thing we're really doing there is guaranteeing that we'll get to live that disaster once. We may get to live it twice, but we'll certainly get it to live once in our own mind, right? And this idea that if we keep living it over and over again within our consciousness, somehow we'll know what to do, it doesn't actually help us in the long range. What we want to ask ourselves is, first of all, is it true now? What is true now? That is the first thing. The second thing is, am I doing everything I can in this moment? If I'm afraid of a dreadful disease, and I keep living it as if, what? How am I going to tell my kids I have that? Meanwhile, you have no reason. You don't have it. But am I doing everything I can now to keep that from happening? Right? And all I can manage is this moment now. And I can offer myself a kind of kindness in the sense of, can I promise myself that when I get to the future, if that happens, I will meet that then with my full presence. That's all I can offer myself, right? Can I bring my attention back to, because what I'm really doing is I'm missing out again on the present moment. I have kidnapped myself from the present moment. I'm living a hellscape in preparation for a hellscape, and I have robbed myself of this moment. So can I come back to now, do everything I can, right? Take the steps, but then get to a place where I am very real about it, right? Is this as much as I can do? And is the rest not up to me? That's the piece that we are so resistant to, that it's really not up to us so much of life. And so we bow to the monkey mind trying to keep everything in control, right, by creating it. But really what it continually resists is the impermanence and the not up to usness of life. We do our part, and then the universe is going to send us something, and we'll meet that when we get there. I will tell you one thing. I have never, in all my years of practice, had one of two things happen. I've never had the disaster that was imagined happen that way, right? It always comes in a different form, if it comes. Most don't. And I've never had a client or anyone I've ever known say, I'm really glad I thought about that for those 25 years because I was well prepared when it came down the pike. You know, it just doesn't work as a system. And at the same time, when we get that diagnosis, if we get that diagnosis, right, we are a different person than the person we are now. So again, this surrender to, I don't know how I'm going to hear that when that parent dies. I don't know who I'll be. And so much of finding freedom in thought is allowing I don't know. You know, our thinking mind, we are so conditioned to believe that more thinking means more knowing. More knowing means more control. More control, more success, better life, all of this. And that the solution to every problem is more thinking. Go harder down the rabbit hole. Even if I've done that 25,000 times and there's no solution in there, go down at 25,001 first time. That what we find, it's so, again, paradoxical, is when we relax and say, I don't know. I don't know the answers. And that right now is my destination. In other words, I'm living in the question. That becomes the first place of peace that we really find, because we can't find answers. We can't find the ground we're looking for with more thinking. It just takes us further into suffering. And so one of the things I really hope people walk away after reading this book from is a deep understanding that thinking is often the problem, not the solution. It's like if we want peace, it's like trying to open a lock with a banana. It's just simply the wrong tool. Thinking is the wrong tool for peace. Sometimes it's let it be. I don't know. Right? I'm not the thoughts that are scrambling. One other thing I wanted to mention too that maybe we can pick up on is we are entirely fused with thought. So the fact that you can recognize someone is shouting at you inside your mind or telling you, you know, what terrible things are coming your way is already a good thing. Because for most people, there's no separation. The identification is full on. And we're proud of our thoughts. We're the author, we imagine, of our thoughts. So just even the fact that you could hear what's being shouted at you in your inner radio station already means that we're getting some space and have some choices. The normal person, right, is just fused with thought. They are their thought. And we can't even imagine what would life be, Descartes, I think, therefore I am. I don't exist if I'm not thinking. Mm-hmm. So to the mind, calming and slowing the thinking and having spaces between thoughts is tantamount to non-existence. So yes, we're talking about a really big existential challenge here.
Totally. I mean, we live in a time of where the utmost importance, is placed on expertise and analysis. And in the Epic Times profile about you, you had this quote. I actually cut it out and I taped it in my notebook because it so resonated with me. And you were talking about the ironically, the criticisms that people have of your work or the questions that you get asked. And I'm reading here from the Epic Times article what you said. You said, quote, "What I get asked all the time is, what is the evidence base? Where are the MRIs that you've seen? What's the science in this? How did you figure that out? We have put all of our eggs in the figuring out basket, and it is at the exclusion of so many other ways of being a human being." And I think that's exactly what we do to ourselves. To your point, we think that overthinking, overanalyzing, ruminating, we're like cracking the code, you know? We're doing the science, we're compiling the data, and there's going to be an outcome and we're going to move the ball forward. But to your point, thinking oftentimes is the problem, not the solution.
It is so true. I cannot tell you how often I am asked, you know, where's the data? Where's the data? I want to see the studies. And we have all, that's great. There's nothing wrong with data.
Right.
I'm all for data. And as humans, we have so many ways of knowing that we, in this society, in this time of reason, where reason has kidnapped absolutely everything, that there's one way of knowing, and it is through reason. We have denied ourselves, first of all, the experience of living. By that, I mean that all this thinking, all this trying to control, to understand this giant mystery, right, actually causes us to suffer. Mm. It actually limits us from the vastness of our wisdom, which includes the body. It includes many other aspects of knowing, and those have been discredited to such a degree that we have this tiny little way of doing everything, which really costs us the full capacity of this incarnated existence.
Yes.
And I mean, if that doesn't even resonate with someone, it makes us suffer, because mm-hmm. there are so many things that we can't possibly understand or know, and yet we punish ourselves over and over as if that'll give us some idea of what we're doing on this spinning globe in the midst of galaxies, right? We try and, you know, reduce it, and it's so tragic in a sense to me. And when we're young, you know, I think about all the conditioning, you know, did you think about it? You know, did you think? Why didn't you think? We are raised from the time we create a self that we think is separate to see thinking as an inherently good thing, mm-hmm. as something that is our agency. It gives us control. It's going to change our life for the better. And we completely discount surrender and allowing and this, again, this beautiful space that becomes our refuge, which is, I don't know, more to be revealed.
Mm. You know, you in your writing mention your gut, having a gut feeling. And people have said to me before throughout my life, you know, when I've encountered various issues, they said, well, follow your gut or trust your gut. What does your gut tell you? And whenever people would say that to me, my answer to them would be, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't have a gut feeling. And I think I speak, if I may, I think I speak for a lot of people in my generation, where because we have been bathed in this hyper-rational world where we think we have to do like a cross-data, multi-tested analysis of every single thing, and then that may be contested, and we have to cross-check it with, you know, like we live in this world where everything has to be proven, everything is data, everything is scientific, that we've lost, to your point, you know, this kind of like intrinsic sense, sixth sense that human beings have. And over time, over the past 2 to 3 years, I've really, really tried to make it more of a priority in my life to figure out what my gut is. It's really hard. I'm still figuring it out. I know. I just fell into the trap.
Right.
You don't figure out what you're, but feeling what it is, and I have to learn it. I have to learn the natural thing. Before we continue with Nancy, I want to quickly tell you about MyPillow. I use a lot of MyPillow products. I wear my slippers. I sleep on a MyPillow. I sleep on the Giza Dream bed sheets. I use my towels. And you can get a lot of these products at a discount if you use the promo code Hartman or call 1-800-566-6745. Now, MyPillow is obviously most famous for the pillow, but they also created the Giza Dream bed sheets, which, as I said, I use. They look and feel great, which means an even better night's sleep, which is crucial for our overall health. MyPillow found the world's best cotton called Giza. It's ultra soft and breathable, but extremely durable. These Giza sheets come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a 10-year warranty. They come in a variety of sizes and colors, and you can get them for a limited time at 50% off. You can get a set for as low as $29.98 if you use the promo code Hartman. Just go to MyPillow.com and click on the radio podcast square and use the promo code Hartman. There you will get not only this great offer, but also deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow 2.0 mattress topper, MyPillow kitchen towel sets, and now even flannel sheets and so much more. Call 1-800-566-6745 or go to MyPillow.com and use the promo code Hartman. I have to learn the natural thing.
You do. And I'm so glad that at your age, you're realizing how untethered you are from your gut, because I get a lot of people in my office that are in their 40s and 50s and wake up to this truth that they've never tuned into a kind of intuitive wisdom. And even that, we're laughing, but to figure out what's in your gut is to use the same instrument that created the problem to solve the problem. So we don't learn, and I'm very delighted to hear that there are lots of programs now in elementary schools where they are teaching children to listen inside to their still small voice, to listen to the knowing. And in a sense, what they're teaching children, and I do some of this, is how do you tune in and almost bypass the mind? It feels counterintuitive, but then when that knowing comes back up, we make use of the mind. So the mind is our servant, it's not our master, but the way we go and gather the knowing is in a way that your generation never learned, which is not to think about what we know in our gut, but to ask our gut to tell us. Now, the mind never wants to surrender its throne. It wants to be the one going to find the information and, you know, oh, that's my intuition. But it's all been figured out by the mind. It can't stand deferring to the gut, because remember, the mind imagines that when it's off duty, you don't exist. Mm-hmm. So it's primitive in its understanding that there's no you without it being on the throne and taking charge. So in a sense, we have to let the mind be on holiday. We're coming back. We will get back into obsessing. We can even hear the lovely random crazy thoughts that you're going to send my way, which is a big category, people with just random crazy thoughts that they think they have to convince their mind are not true. And we listen. We learn to listen to a knowing that is not necessarily reason-based. Mm. And very often, that what's so fascinating is that will speak, that gut, that heart speaks and knows in a language that your mind never would construct. Words, I have this happen in my office all the time with people. They use words, or there's a, oh, right, that's what I feel, that's what I want. And then the whole nervous system relaxes because there's a truth in it that's deeper than this is what I should do, this is what I should do, right? The mind pumps out what I should do. The gut often pumps out, what is my longing? What do I want? Mm. They're very different. And so it's just fascinating when the knowing comes from somewhere else and there's a deep, deep relaxation because it's true.
Mm. I think a lot of people worry that if they changed their thought cycle, even if they recognize that there's an element of their thought cycle which is harmful to them, I think people worry that if they changed it, they would stop being who they are. And on this show, over the past month and a half, I was lucky enough to interview two men who both were alcohol and drug addicts. And they were just, I mean, these episodes were overwhelming in the wisdom that they shared getting sober and finding God and really just building a better lives for themselves. But both of them said something that every addict, whether it's addiction to alcohol, drugs, bad thoughts, you know, eating disorders, every addict says this. that they feared if they got off the drugs, they got off the alcohol, they got off mm-hmm. the, you know, obsessive rumination, they wouldn't be as creative. They wouldn't have as much fun. They wouldn't be as ambitious. I mean, that's something I worry about. Well, I go, well, you know, Julie, if you quiet that voice in your head telling you all the ways that you were doing something wrong, then you're not going to get better. You're going to be complacent and you're not going to grow. And so I almost feel like I would be losing a part of myself if I gave right. this up. I'm sure you hear this a lot. What is your response
all
to that?
All the time. It's funny, when I first pitched the publisher about thinking as an addiction, and it doesn't have to just be to negative thinking, just thinking that we're constantly thinking as an addiction that we don't even realize we have, the pushback was frequently, so you want me to sit and look at a wall and chant Om for the rest of my life? That's and it's a life with no drama. Who would want a life without drama? And it's very similar, as I talk about in the book, to what addicts say, like, I won't have a personality. If you take away my drink, life won't be fun. Why would I be alive? Mm-hmm. And it's so threatening because we're so identified. Again, we are our thoughts. So, and we think that our thoughts are what make us inherently interesting and also what make us productive, because the mind has convinced us and our conditioning that without it spurring us and without its help all the time, there's nothing there. And so when we start to practice getting our thoughts out in front of us and even starting to see some gaps in thought, we experience ourselves as present and as someone who's fascinating without the constant thought stream. But we have to take the risk that it is to disengage. We have to not bite the hook when the mind throws us all of these different juicy thought trains to follow. We have to be willing to do that in order to discover how joyful and peaceful life is when we're not thinking all the time, right? It's almost like we have to fake it till we can make it, because we're being told there's nothing there and it will be a big drag if we're not thinking all the time, which present evidence is not supporting, because most of the time, our thinking is creating suffering. So this great time that it's trying to convince you that you're having is not actually happening. So we have to practice that when, right when we're in the thick of it, when the mind is saying you can't possibly disengage from this thought stream, because if you find the solution to this problem, all of your problems will be solved. Every single one. This is the one. This is the one you can't leave. It's leaving right there, coming back to the present moment and perhaps the sensations in our body or a sound. We have to get back through the portal of the body into the present moment. We have to practice that to see that we don't die. We don't become not interesting. The mind is still very much, our thoughts are available to us, but they are just not dragging us around our lives.
You know, achieving this nirvana, that's what it sounds like, honestly, nirvana, heaven, is a lifelong endeavor, as you very well know. But I wonder, how would you advise someone to take the first step? If they suffer from anxiety, rumination, self-doubt, and they want to, in small ways, try to rectify that, what would be some exercises that you would recommend?
Well, first, I think it's incredibly helpful to 5 minutes a day, just see if you can sit down and turn the lens at your own mind. Just watch it. And that practice, so that we're getting the mind's nonsense, it's spinning out in front of us. We're disengaging. We're not merged with it in that moment. So that has to be a practice. Mm-hmm. And 5 minutes a day, we're coming down below the neck. We're stopping and dropping. We're stopping for a moment. taking a break from the contents of mind, and we're dropping into the body, and we're just paying attention to the sensations, the sounds, the breath. Those are necessary practices to start to break this addiction. The other thing I would say is, every once in a while, when you're down the rabbit hole and you're being shouted at or terrified or told that you're going to push that person into the subway tracks or whatever insanity this crazy mind and crazy computer is telling you, take a moment and identify with the you that's listening. Right? So turn and face it and say, it's not helpful, or stop trying to frighten me, right? Or have I done everything I can? You can get into a kind of more sane relationship with your thoughts. You can recognize what is it you're really trying to do here that's helpful. And you can engage with that. And if none of that works, because it's not a failing if it doesn't work, you can say, stop it. Stop it. Stop talking to me like that. We can also start to get interested in what life is like, right? If we're not trying to figure everything out. Mm-hmm. If we start to live in questions and say, I don't know, what's it like to live with the question, right? To take yourself off the hook in a certain sense, to have to know everything. It's okay to not know everything. It's okay to be a work in progress. Both exist. So we remind ourselves, as someone who loves us, right? You're allowed to have done that really, really well and have things to learn from it. But what we want to do again and again and again, like weeds grow, we pluck them, weeds grow, come back to the present moment. We're lost in these narratives. 99% of our lives we miss. We're telling ourselves a story about why our friend's face looked like that. She hates me. I didn't give her a good present, whatever. And then we come to find out 3 weeks later she just had a tooth pulled, and we've been living this horror and reacting to it as if it's true. Suggest that maybe that version, maybe my narrative on what just happened isn't true. Come back to the present moment, back to the present. Doubt your thoughts, doubt your narratives. They are all about us. They're not about what's true or the world. And one of the main things I work with people on and talk about in the book is this construction of a story about, I have a pain in my foot right now. Many people would go all the way right to how long do I have?
Yes.
It's going to be cancer, undoubtedly, right? And then we're making plans for our finances. And, you know, stepped on a Lego, right? That's actually what happened. But we do this with everything. We do this with everything. They hate me because of this. I did that. It's all a movie. Everyone is living a movie in their head.
Boy.
And it's not the same movie. And it's so interesting, you know, Julie, as a couples therapist, I will often ask the two people to describe an evening date. Other than the name of the movie, nothing is the same of what happened. So when you get that, right, and you can wear your own truth a little bit more lightly, then this amazing thing happens where two realities can coexist. So, oh, wow, that's what it was like for you. Oh, this is what it was like for me. And we don't have to sort of smash our truth into everybody we meet so that we can continue being okay, right? We get it that our movie is just a construction of our memories and thoughts and parents and all the rest. It's not truth. Not truth. And it certainly isn't anyone else's truth.
I love this idea.
It just lightens everything.
Everyone is living a movie. It is so true.
Completely.
It is.
Everyone's lost in a movie.
God, that is such a good way to put it. And how ironic is that? Because we're all here in the present. We should be focused on the present, but everyone's playing their film in their mind, keeping us from the present.
Which they believe.
Right.
Which they believe is true, and then are acting on it as if it's true.
Yes.
So that recognition, it's just a construction. I teach people how to come back to what actually happened. Because we're so far away from what happened into the meaning of it, which is, you know, I'm the star of the show. I'm the author of the show. In the movie, I play every part. I'm, you know, it's, and everything happens because of me. I'm the center of the universe in the story as well. So if I just come back and back and back to what are the simple facts of what happened? So her faith looked funny to you, you know, literally we, to get the story out can take an hour of a simple incident because our mind has already kind of cloaked it and infused it with the meaning that is just of our own thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's one thing I recommend for people in terms of changing your life, it's recognizing that what is happening in your mind is not the truth.
In our final time, I want to talk about social media because you wrote a book on it. I just did a show on it, and it is, I think, one of the biggest issues in my generation. We know there is just copious amounts of data. I know that we're talking about the realm of life that doesn't have to do with data, but both from a anecdotal perspective and a data-driven perspective, social media is causing a lot of harm to young people especially. And, you know, if you look at the two things that we were just discussing, how people are living in a fake world in their heads, you know, they're playing a movie, and also people put themselves at the center of the world, and everything that happens is surrounding them, and everybody's thinking about them. Social media exacerbates and fuels both of those problems, living in a fake world and making you the center of the universe. So what would you advise parents or people, you know, my age to do to change their relationship or their kids' relationships with social media? Should they just totally get off of it? Or is it possible to have somewhat of a tempered, healthy relationship with it?
Gosh, it is such a complicated question. Yeah. And, you know, as a mom of two daughters, I watched as it became more important to present a character rather than to be that person.
Yes,
right?
Totally.
So that their identity online and their followers and their, you know, all of it replaced some kind of authentic self. I actually have watched it. I am happy to report that my 20-year-old is finding, as are her friends, that being with her friends is far more satisfying, and being real, she's finding it on her own, right? My teen, on the other hand, is full on in it, and self-worth is about followers, and I don't know if it's possible. It feels a bit like social suicide to remove children from all social media, because it is where life happens now.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I am deeply, deeply concerned about what it is doing to not just our children's mental health, but it is causing, I believe, this crisis of loneliness. It is in its, it is an addiction that, I have my doubts if that wasn't already known, that this would be the end result. We have gotten our children addicted. And now it's not just like a television where you go home and watch the television. It is in every aspect of their lives. And it is jacking them up and amping them up and creating more suicidality than we've ever seen, ever. It is not good for us. So what I would suggest in families, and this is what, you know, we've done our best to instill, is to be mindful of how do you feel when you've been out and you've been, you know, on all the sites all day. How do you feel? Because the day that we lose touch with what is this actually doing to us, and this becomes our norm, just our resting state, is the day that we've disappeared. We've disappeared into HAL, you know, the great computer of 2001, Space Odyssey. So I continually point my children back to what's it like for you when you're on a play date and everyone's talking to somebody on their phone. Mm-hmm. And they're not with you and you're in the room. Staying in touch with that. And we have to, you know, it's practice, practice, practice. It's very yes. unsexy in that way. You're on the bus, don't get on your phone. You're in your bathroom, don't get on your phone. Never a phone at a meal. Never, ever, ever a phone at a meal. After 9 o'clock, with an hour or two downtime to let the nervous system calm down, we are off. We are not on the phone throughout the night. We do not wake up and get on email. We say something about our day, an intention. We're grateful. We do something, a body practice. We look at our mind before we pick up the phone. There are a whole bunch of things in my book that are very practical. We can't just talk about this theoretically. We have to actually put the phone down. Yes. I recommend people take a 10-minute walk every single day where they don't have their phone. Imagine. Parents say to me, are you crazy? What if my child need me? It's like, you know, you call child welfare or something if you're out of touch for 10 minutes. I notify people that I don't pick up email for, 6 hours of the day. I pick it up at these times, and people know that. Or between 2 and 4, I'm not reachable. Mm-hmm. The old-fashioned way, right? So if we need to build in, the people will know that. But this, we have to not respond to the text right away. We have to walk it. We have to walk it. And it's like any addiction, until we get our legs, right, it feels like we're missing out. And then very soon, we start to feel, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. I don't have my phone. Thank goodness. Thank goodness.
It's a relief.
Right? It is. It is. So in the book, I talk about some very specific, but those are some. But with kids, keep pointing them to what's this like for you. Mm-hmm. Keep them in touch with the experience of it, right? And of course, get them into sports and get them into music and get them into things where their self-esteem is not dependent upon this nonsense of who likes me and the perception of me, which girls are even more susceptible
yes.
to.
Yes.
Build their self-esteem in ways that they have agency over.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, though, Nancy. You know, I was talking about a few minutes ago how when people would encourage me to follow my gut, my answer to them would be, I don't know what you're talking about. When people imagine what it would be like to go 6 hours without their phone, they literally cannot conceptualize how they would fill that time. And it is so relevant to our discussion about negative thoughts, because social media fuels negative thoughts, but social media for many is the escapism from negative thoughts. And I find that when I'm sitting on the couch and I'm, you know, thinking about my day and all of the things that I could have done better and all of the things that I did wrong and all of the ways my life is not, you know, shaping out the way I think it should shape out, etc., you know what I do? I pick up my phone and I just go, I need to find something. I need to look at something on Instagram, and it takes me away.
The thing is, I mean, what's so heartbreaking to me is I have watched it with so many parents where the picking up the social media destroys our imagination.
Yeah.
So for you, what walks in are these negative thoughts. But very often I hear people talk about, I don't know how to fill that space.
Yeah.
I need content. I need my mind to be jacked up and entertained and at every second. We no longer know how to engage ourselves in this giant world. We have no interest. We have no way of generating our own imagination. So what's happening is that we are becoming more and more dependent on the technology to fill these holes, these empty vesicles that we are. So I would say if what rushes in is this negativity, well, you got to work with the negativity.
Yeah.
You know, to just usher it out of the room, right, is to be actually kind of powerless in your own system. It's like, you know, just anesthetizing. You might as well just put something in your arm. It's not really that different.
Right.
So I want people to be able to live in their actual reality. And the worst part of it for children is they actually lose the sense that they can create life. They can come up with something to do. They can think of something or get interested in something. I was reading some study that children don't want to play instruments anymore. They don't want to learn languages. They don't, because why would they? They're just passively receiving content from this, you know, sneaker to this video game to, we're just filling until what? Until we die? So the essence of the human being that generates interesting, imaginative, all of it, is being sort of bred out of us,
yes,
if you will. So if you're filling that space, maybe for 10 minutes, turn towards it rather than go look at vacations. Right?
The word you just said, filling, you know, we're filling our lives, we're filling our time, we're filling our minds with things. Life was not made to be filled. Life was made to be lived. And
that's right.
As trite as it sounds, what I try to do on this show with my different topics is I try to renew that sense of interest in life and provide alternatives for people away from, you know, just scrolling or ruminating. People always say to me, you have the most random topics on your show. I had a handwriting analysis expert. I did a show on flags. I did a show on owls. I had a magician on the show.
But you're curious.
Yes.
And you're curious. And that's a dying art. And that is the most magnificent quality of the human being. And I so appreciate your show because it is just that, is the delight of, oh my goodness, how can you say that it's boring? How can you possibly say, well, then pay attention to boredom. Is boredom boring to get interested in, right? So what's lovely about your topics is that it shows a delight for life. And I want to instill that in our children. So
yes,
you take away the phone on Sunday and you get them into a class. I don't care if you want to go or not, in pottery. Okay, you didn't like that one? All right, we're going to go learn about the stars. Or we want to feel alive and also lucky to have this incarnated being, because what comes with the emptiness, Julie, is depression. Because when we can't fill it, and we have a moment where we're not entertained and, oh my goodness, there's a gap, what that gets filled in with is depression and emptiness and the vacuum. So we've lost our tether, not just to our gut, but to our vitality in that way, and our curiosity.
Mm-hmm. And having
so as parents, again, I just want to say, you got to walk the walk. You're not there to be a buddy. You're not there to just make them like you. That we've gotta play tough guy to some degree. You lose your phone. Put your phone away. Off. Not on vibration at the table. Off. You don't wake up to it, right? We have to really play that part, and we have to keep talking to them and building their self-esteem so they know a little bit of life that's not about the phone. They know an experience. Take them hiking. These kinds of things, because the young generation now, I mean, you're on the cusp there, but you have a little bit of a memory, I imagine, of an analog world. But I know when I talk to my young teen about, you know, the meaning of being with people or the awkward silences or knowing how to talk to another human and look them in the face and all these things, they don't really have a memory of it so much, playing soccer on that, you know, on that ground that had the dew just coming up, or tacking up that horse and hearing the whinnies from around. They don't have it. They have the virtual version of it. So I worry that we have to get them in those activities where they experience life without technology.
Parents have to be the tough guys, but also when you're my age, when you're 24, you've got to be the tough guy with yourself. And that's something I have learned mm-hmm. with social media, with obsessive rumination. You have to discipline yourself and you have to get out of those patterns.
You have to do it, but you have to do it kindly.
I know. When I said the word discipline, I thought, oh gosh, I'm falling right back in. At least I'm aware.
You are. Yep. Right. So, and we need a guide to say, well, look how you just kind of talk to yourself a little bit nastily there.
Yes.
Right. It was a slippery slope there. But so we do have to tip our hat to this stuff is addictive. You know, they have thousands of experts there that have studied the casino machines. How often do you have, when does the Twitter, when they know how to get us in there.
Yeah.
Right. And eyes are money. We know that. So, we recognize this is addictive. It feels like we're missing out. And there's something deeper and richer in life that I want. So it's not about saying, you know, it's not hard. We acknowledge that. And we keep turning towards, but we don't want to feel this helpless to our reality. We want to feel curious. We want to have a conversation with someone where they aren't being interrupted all the time by who's calling, right? We have to move towards what we want by doing these very hard things.
Nancy, thank you so much for your time today. You've made just such spectacular and immensely helpful points. And I can't tell you how much I loved your book. For those of you who want to buy it, buy it. You are going to have a much better, healthier life if you read this. It's called Can't Stop Thinking, How to Let Go of Anxiety and Free Yourself from Obsessive Rumination. You can find out more about Nancy by going to nancycollier.com, and Collier is spelled with one L. And Nancy, you'll have to come back on once I read your social media book.
I'd be delighted. It's wonderful talking to you, and I'm so thrilled with your curiosity.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I'll see you soon on the show, and I hope to see all of you soon. You can email me in the meantime at julie@julie-hartman.com with your thoughts about this episode or any other episode. I'll see you soon. Take care.